Listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria's CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, ZKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia. I'm featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we discuss how Doug Ford and Mark Carney's housing policies heavily favor corporate landlords. On The Breach Show, talk about the best-case outcome of the NDP leadership race on the North State, and speak with the World Bank's chief climate economist about the links between climate change and poverty on Green Majority. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by the new Between the Lines books release, Women United, Stories of Women's Struggles for Equality in the Canadian Auto Workers Union. In this anthology, Peggy Nash and Julie White present firsthand stories of dozens of women leaders in the CAW, documenting the decades-long struggle of generations of women activists in the union who, despite their few numbers, managed to build a better, more inclusive labor movement, making an important contribution to feminist, labor, and social history. Founded in 1977, Between the Lines publishes nonfiction books that expose and challenge oppression in Canadian society. Find your copy of Women United, Stories of Women's Struggles for Equality in the Canadian Auto Workers Union at btlbooks.com. This episode of Harbinger Showcase is also brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged. Launched in 2023 as response to Meta's Canadian news ban, Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism on the hour, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, The Grind in Toronto, The Independent in St. John's, and national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and 24 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at unrigged.ca. This episode of Harbinger Showcase is also brought to you by the Alberta Advantage podcast. Based in Calgary, this collective of more than 20 activists, academics, and journalists have been broadcasting award-winning political commentary, news, and analysis since 2017. On this excerpt from a March 2021 episode, Team Advantage convenes to discuss universal basic income and how its appeal relates to left-wing politics and strategy. Now, here's the show. Makes no difference where I
go. Is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Check out our partner shows at harbingermedianetwork.com. This independent listener-supported podcast is possible thanks to listeners like you. If you think what we do is important, support us with a monthly donation at patreon.com/albertaadvantage. Hello and welcome to the Alberta Advantage. I am your host, Kate Jacobson, and joining Team Advantage today, we have Roberta.
Hello.
Patrick.
Hello.
And Tyler.
Hi there.
So we're getting together today to discuss universal basic income, which is a proposal that has increasingly been floated as a solution to the multitude of political and economic problems that we're facing as a society. I want to be honest right from the start that, generally speaking, the Alberta Advantage team does oppose basic income, and we think it's ultimately a bad idea. But before getting into our reasons for concluding that it's ultimately a bad idea, we wanted to do an honest and hopefully generous exploration that's like worth thinking through why it is this idea of basic income is so compelling. And how we're going to do that is we're going to do something kind of strange with our argument here. We are going to point out what we think are basic income's strongest points in favor before telling you ultimately why we're not the biggest fans of it as a political proposal. I think to begin with, we need to define our terms somewhat. So what is basic income or universal basic income?
A truly universal basic income would involve unconditional periodic cash payments that a government would make to everyone with no strings attached. No strings attached means no means testing, no testing to see what your income last year was to see if you qualify, no disqualifications for people who worked too much or too little, no disqualifications for students or if you served in the military or voted or not. Universal in this case would mean everyone. And the idea is that it's paid in cash. It's not food stamps or something that qualifies you to get subsidized government supplied goods or anything like that. It's just a check that gets written to you, deposited in your account, and you decide how it gets spent. It's envisioned as a floor for people's income. You can't technically make less than this because it's guaranteed to you.
So basic income proposals aren't a completely new idea. These have been floating around for quite some time. And from the Basic Income Canada Network, they talk about how there's been a form of basic income in Canada since 1967 with income guarantees for seniors. This is still in operation today in the form of Old Age Security Program, which is universal, and the Guaranteed Income Supplement, which is a means-tested program. So we have kind of two income supplements that exist for seniors. And in Canada, children's benefits often work the same way. They're provided as top-ups to low-income families to create a base income that's supposedly above the poverty line. And I say supposedly because they're not always that good at figuring that part out. Now, advocates of basic income spend a lot of time emphasizing that it is not welfare, in big capital letters, not welfare. The universal aspect of basic income is one of the key aspects that distinguishes it from other income support programs like welfare. When programs get targeted at, quote, problems like unemployment, they often get stigmatized. There's an unfortunate sense that someone has done something wrong or made some sort of bad decision, somehow deserves to be poor. When they're supported by welfare or other kinds of supports, we make this assumption about people. It's this phrase of on the dole, and there's a very negative connotation to that. Now, this, of course, is bullshit because unemployment is a structural feature of capitalism. There's a guaranteed unemployment built into the system for various reasons, in particular to keep costs of labor low. And it makes no sense to individualize blame for the structural features of our economy. But the point here is that by making a program universal, you prevent it from getting stigmatized. It applies to everyone, not just, quote, the people with a problem. All Canadians deserve this program.
If we look a little further back, there's some other examples that we can draw from. So Huey Long, a populist senator from Louisiana, proposed a minimum income of $2,000 to $2,500 in 1934 and a maximum income of 300 times the average. G.D.H. Cole, an economist at Oxford, advanced a social dividend as part of a planned economy and coined the term basic income in 1953. In the 1960s, there was an increase in popularity in the idea. It was supported by Martin Luther King, and their experiments run in New Jersey, Iowa, North Carolina, Indiana, Seattle, Denver, and Manitoba. Nixon actually pushed to make it federal law in this time period as well. Manitoba's minimum income, or MINCOM, pilot project took place in 1970 in the city of Dauphin, Manitoba. Economist Evelyn Forget studied the data from the project and found that hospital visits dropped 8.5%, fewer work-related injuries and incidents, fewer emergency room visits from accidents and injuries, a reduction in rates of psychiatric hospitalization, and reduction in the number of mental illness-related consultations with health professionals. More recently, Ontario ran a basic income pilot project. It was started in April 2017 by the Ontario Liberal Party and was canceled after the 2018 election of Ontario's Progressive Conservatives under Doug Ford.
So that's what basic income involved sort of historically, or the meaning of the terms and the kind of some of the historical trajectory of it. I think we should now move to thinking about basic income in a modern context. And the reason this is important is that there are essentially a number of visions or proposals for basic income, and they span the political spectrum quite drastically. So on the right wing of these proposals, some would like a basic income that isn't universal. So a basic income that excluded particular parts of the population, like, for example, people who don't have citizenship or aren't citizens of the country they're residing in. This could obviously very, very easily lead to creating basically a nationalistic and likely an overtly racist kind of basic income or basic income project. also on kind of the right wing of the political spectrum, is this idea that we can use basic income to replace any and all existing welfare programs and supports with simple basic income programs. So that means no food stamps, no social assistance, no Medicare, no after-school programs, no childcare, just write everyone a check and let the market decide. Very, very similar to the way that Republicans and many Democrats in the United States are into this idea of like school vouchers, where it's like everyone gets like a certain amount of, or everyone gets a voucher that they can spend on attending like one of the variety of charter schools in the area. Obviously, these are very right-wing interpretations and proposals of basic income. And when most like progressives or NDPers or left-wing people talk about basic income or propose a form of basic income, this is obviously not what they're talking about. But I do think it is important to acknowledge that just because someone is talking about basic income doesn't necessarily mean it's a good idea. The devil is certainly in the details here. And also that there are right-wing versions of basic income. It's not an inherently progressive or left-wing idea.
Well, and I think this is something really important to talk about in terms of universal basic income, that I actually came across this idea originally from a proposal being put forward by conservatives in Canada during the kind of 2000s and the major cutbacks to the social safety net. And there's a lot of conservatives who propose universal basic income because it's cheaper. It's a way to cut back on government bureaucracy, and it's a way to kind of funnel all the social services into one area. And our good friend David Frum is a big proponent of this kind of idea. It's been proposed by people like Marco Rubio, Paul Ryan, and others who really see universal basic income as a good idea, but not for the reasons that many progressives, I think, would, in that they're trying to actually cut back on government intervention, bureaucracy, and the cost of social welfare, and trying to get people off of these programs and make it seem horrible. So we should always keep that in mind when people are talking about universal basic income.
Many of the more serious proposals for basic income come from the left wing of the political spectrum, and it's these that we want to examine more closely and what the positive and liberatory aspects of them are, i.e., what is it about universal basic income that is so appealing? And I think one of the really main parts of that is that it has a very utopian edge to it, right? It suggests a world where A, you are not going to starve and get kicked out of your house and maybe die just because you're not working. And B, that you also might be free to not work, you know, meaning that you could do any number of things with your waking hours, like read, care for and spend time with the people who are important in your life, learn a language, learn how to play an instrument, go for really long walks, any number of the beautiful, pleasurable, and enjoyable things we do in our lives and our leisure time. And the idea that this would give more people the freedom to not work. And this is very, very appealing.
Often the conversation about basic income gets wrapped up in conversations about technical details, whether or not it would have the right effects on poverty, whether or not it would disincentivize people to work, and these kinds of questions. These two points tend to get overlooked, and they're probably the most compelling parts of any kind of universal basic income proposal. You won't starve and die in poverty because of capitalism, very important. And you might actually have more control of your own life by having money, more money than you currently have, or certainly much more money than you would have if you stopped working. And second to that, time that you can actually decide what to do with.
This is a really important point, because what we're talking about here is a real kind of freedom. And we're going to harp on it here because talking about it, it's often like, you know, the rhetoric of freedom has been captured as this right-wing talking point. Right. But in this right wing sense, freedom is about being able to do capitalism, to choose Coke or Pepsi in the soft drink aisle, to be that jackass making fun of like not having 100 different tomato sauce choices when he was in Cuba or whatever. But this right wing version of freedom has always been shallow, and embedded in left politics has always been the sense that the real freedom means liberating people from the drudgery of work and the tyranny of bosses, landlords, and patriarchal family bonds. And an important part of this freedom is freedom from work, the freedom provided by leisure. And this is not a new idea. I mean, it's really baked into all the old power structures of our societies. A key marker of all of the old pre-capitalist aristocratic elites was leisure. they may have had various social and political and military obligations that they had to fulfill as part of their social role. But the ruling elite also had time for leisure, for sport and hunting and grand tours and intellectual projects, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And this, marked them out as different from the laboring masses.
And on the other side of the equation, a really key battle of the working class under capitalism has always been around the length of the working day, i.e. how much of your life do you have to give to making surplus value and making profit to capitalists? And in turn, of course, what is the remaining time that is available for workers to develop themselves, i.e. this free time or this leisure time? Marx in Volume 1 of Capital has a whole chapter that's called The Working Day, and it goes into really great detail about how, you know, the length of a working day is a key battle between the working class and the bourgeoisie. You know, you'll hear unions talk about this all the time, you know, like unions invented like the 8-hour workday. That's because the length of the workday is a really big part of the fight between the working class and the bourgeoisie.
Those the Alberta Advantage. Find out more about the show at albertaadvantagepod.com and hear the rest of the conversation at harbingermedianetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. Broadcasting since 2022, The Breach Show is a bi-weekly podcast featuring sharp commentary on politics and movements in Canada. On this excerpt from a new episode, Desmond Cole sits down with Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives economist Ricardo Tranjan to discuss how Ontario Premier Doug Ford and Prime Minister Mark Carney's housing policies heavily favour corporate landlords. Now, here's the show.
Welcome to The Breach Show, featuring sharp analysis on politics and social movements in Canada. I'm your host, Desmond Cole. Landlords across the country are pressuring governments to give them more power in their relationship with tenants. Ontario Premier Doug Ford recently tabled a bill that, among other things, opened the door to letting landlords decide the length of lease agreements. But after tenants' rights groups like Acorn mobilized and tens of thousands of workers contacted the government to say, no way, Ford backed off. However, there's plenty of other concerning changes in the rest of that bill, and we're going to explore some of them today. Plus, the federal government has a new housing organization with a new leader whose mandate is to build more affordable housing across the country. But how likely is it that Build Canada Homes will make a dent in the lack of affordable housing stock? To explore all this, I'm joined today by Ricardo Tranjan, a political economist and senior researcher with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. He previously managed Toronto's poverty reduction strategy and has taught at universities in Quebec and Ontario. Hi, Ricardo.
Hello.
Let's start in Ontario. Premier Doug Ford has introduced what he calls the Fighting Delays, Building Faster Act. I will never tire of these entertaining legislation titles. This is a jumble of legislation. It's really an omnibus bill around transportation, the landlord and tenant board, and also housing. The provision that's gotten the most attention is the one that's already been backed down from by the government. It was a rule to change how lease agreements work in Ontario. So right now, when you sign a lease, you can stay indefinitely in Ontario unless there are certain legal reasons that the landlord has to take the unit back. Ford's government had proposed a rule that would, quote, allow landlords to control who occupies their units and for how long, unquote. As I mentioned, the government backed down from this proposal almost immediately after outcry from renters and housing advocates. But Ricardo, what should we make of the Ford government's attempt to even pass such a rule in the first place?
That's a great question. I think we need to take a step back from the policy, from the government of the day, for who the premier is right now, and just take account of the fact that this Bill 60, specifically the aspect on tenant protections, is the most vicious, one-sided legislation that we have seen since tenant-landlord relations began to be regulated in the 1960s. And when the legislation was introduced, we looked it up and we saw a number of MPPs, and we saw side by side with them the representative of the biggest landlord lobbying organization in Ontario on stage, standing side by side with the MPPs, introducing this vicious piece of legislation that contains a direct attack on tenant rights. For the lobbying group, this was a historical moment where they got the government of the day to put forward a legislation that essentially encompasses all of their dreams, essentially takes away tenant rights, tenant protections, remove rent controls. And that was a big moment for them, I can only imagine. And then in the next, you know, couple of days, there's a popular outcry, and then the politicians in the room decided to take a step back and pull back on the piece on fixed term leases, right?
Right.
So they say, okay, this didn't pass. And so what we have to remember is two things. First, there's a bunch of other pieces on that legislation that are going to have a very negative impact on housing security for tenants. And the second piece is that lobbying group is not going anywhere.
Right.
Maybe they didn't get it this time, but they went this time. They got as far as getting the government of the day to try the waters. They tried the water. They kind of pulled back. But that lobbying group that is behind that the government's proposal is not going anywhere. And then the way our economy works, our economic system works, and the way the housing market works in particular, that lobby group, it's only getting more influential, more powerful, and able to spend more and more resources in that kind of lobbying.
The technical briefing that the government used to justify each of these different changes that are in the legislation, we're going to go over some more of them in a moment. Am I correct in my understanding that it sounds like what the government is saying here is this will increase housing supply because when landlords are able to get rid of their tenants more quickly without more recourse for them to say, well, I'd like to stay, that will open up more of the housing market. That is the argument here from the government, is it not?
One of the rationale provided for it was that people who have empty units, either empty houses, empty condos, whatever it may be, and they don't rent them out because they don't want to, you know, be in the hook with indefinite leases. So the argument, it's very weak for a number of reasons. The first reason is that we don't have that many vacant units to start with. The Auditor General, when introducing the legislation, he said that could, you know, bring to the market tens of thousands or maybe hundreds of thousands of units. And that number, it's an absurd exaggeration. It makes no sense, you know, when you look at the actual data that we have on vacant units in Ontario. And the second piece that it doesn't make any sense is because it's currently, even if you have indefinite term leases, landlords do have the right to take the unit back if they're moving back in or if a family member is moving back in, and they have the right to sell the unit at any given time. So to say that, you know, that fact that it's an indefinite term lease is discouraging this landlords from putting their units in the market, It's a very deliberately disingenuous argument, I would say.
No, thank you for explaining it, because I've been trying to make more sense of it and having a hard time, as you can see. It would be easy to claim that this show of force by renters that forced the government to back down on this one piece of their bill was an opportunity to claim victory, but of course, many other threatening changes remain. So, particularly related to the Landlord-Tenant Board, and I want to go over a few of them. The Landlord-Tenant Board, of course, is the body that adjudicates disputes in Ontario between landlords and tenants, and whose mandate many believe, many know, is already extremely weighted in favor of landlords. So, Ricardo, this proposed law would also do things like shorten the length of time that a landlord has to wait before filing an eviction. It would cut the amount of time that parties have to file a review of an LTB decision. It also removes the requirement in some cases that a landlord has to compensate somebody for the situation that you just mentioned, which is the landlord says, I want to move back into your unit. I want a family member to move back into your unit. The rule stands now that if a landlord wants to do that and they don't give you more than 3 months of notice, then they have to compensate you and give you an opportunity to find a new place. This would remove that provision. So I want to ask you, what do you see as the cumulative effect of all of these changes if they were to pass?
I think we're moving towards a evict first, ask questions later approach. That's essentially, I think, what all of these measures combined will do. We're fast-tracking evictions. We're giving tenants less time, fewer recourse, fewer opportunities to appeal decisions. We're just making it so that once you get an eviction notice, there's very little you can do. And it's most likely that you will get evicted, that you will have to vacate your unit. That's the combined impact of these various measures. They all kind of hit at the same thing. There's even one of the measures that removes some of the discretion of LTB abdicators, where right now, when making a call on an eviction order, they're allowed to take into account the special circumstances of a family, particularly if the family has children, if anyone in the family has a physical disability, and use that information, not necessarily to cancel the eviction order, but to at least provide the family with more time to vacate the unit. They're even removing that, which is just cruel. Right. And so all of them combined, we're going to see likely a lot more evictions streamlined, and it's going to be bad. I'm sorry, but it's going to be bad.
It doesn't sound very good. Somebody that you work with took notice of something very interesting, a piece of language in this legislation, in this proposal. I want to read it. Quote, Tribunals Ontario is exploring options to increase access to landlord-tenant board decision orders with the aim of providing greater access and transparency of its decisions. The increased access will be another vetting resource available to landlords and tenants to consult prior to entering lease agreements, unquote. Now, that could sound good on the surface. I mean, everyone likes transparency, everyone likes access. What is it that you find concerning, though, Ricardo, about that language that I just read?
My interpretation of that proposal is that the government is intending to allow landlords to have access to the records of a tenant. Meaning, if you ever fell into arrears and because of that you're evicted, that gets recorded somewhere within the landlord and tenant board, and then future landlords will be able to go and check to see if you have any history there. And if you do, they may choose not to rent to the unit. The question is, who else? You know, it's already bad in itself that landlords would be able to check your quote-unquote record. But then there's a question of who else can check that. Would prospective employers also be able to go and check and see if you have a quote-unquote record on the landlord and tenant board? Who else has access to that very private information? So if you combine the potential impact of that with the impact of the previous measures that we just discussed, you have two very potentially damaging changes. One, you're going to streamline evictions and make it easier to push people out of their homes. And then you're going to create a record on everyone that has been evicted out of their homes so that potentially they're going to have a really hard time finding housing again, right? So what the government
could essentially function as a blacklist.
Exactly. I think what the government's doing here, and which is extremely disconcerting, is that it's not only fast-tracking evictions, but it's at the same time also proposing to put evicted tenants on some sort of blacklist. So people will be pushed out of their homes and they're going to have a really hard time finding housing in the future, because all prospective landlords will be able to check on them and say, like, I'm not renting to that person. So you are essentially, you know, creating a group of people, a share of your residents of your city who will be sentenced to a life of housing insecurity. That's extremely disconcerting and should be a cause of concern, not only to all the housing advocates and the social movements out there, but I would argue that mayors should be really concerned about this as well.
That's a highlight from a new episode of The Breach Show. Listen to the rest of the interview wherever you get your podcasts and at harbingermedianetwork.com. And find more journalism for transformation at breachmedia.ca. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode is brought to you by the new Between the Lines books release, Women United, Stories of Women's Struggles for Equality in the Canadian Auto Workers Union.